Continuing here on the Jake Asman Show, I'm excited about our next guest. And, of course, is the baseball postseason. The World Series starts on Tuesday. But there is a new book all about Babe Ruth that is now out, and a New York Times best-selling author is the one who wrote it. That is Jane Levy. She is the author of The Big Fella, Babe Ruth, and the World He Created. And she's nice enough to join us now on the BetDSI.com Inside Line. Jane, appreciate your time. Thanks for taking time out of your day to come on SB Nation Radio. And how are you?
I'm. It's kind of a magic carpet ride at the moment, and it's adrenaline fueled, so I'm doing great. The reviews have been fabulous, and I'm running around the country traipsing after the Babe on his barnstorming tour, which was sort of forms the spine of the book, if you will. And so I'm having a great time.
Jane, as a native New Yorker and, of course, a Yankees fan, I obviously grew up knowing who Babe Ruth is and obviously heard a lot of the legendary stories about him. You spent 8 years researching this book. So how did Babe Ruth become Babe Ruth as we know him today?
Well, you know, he, aside from a little bit of talent, he had very good timing. He comes along and he's at the peak of his powers, which were significant, just as the technological revolution is taking over in America. All the industry that had gone into supporting World War I was now looking for outlets for consumer spending. And all the technology and the scientists were developing radios and telegraphs that could send back lots of bars of information, and even a telepix system designed by the Chicago Tribune that could allow you to send overnight a picture from New York to Chicago or New York to Los Angeles. So the whole idea of fame and what it meant to be famous was being redefined and literally amplified. So, for example, in 1921, at the Polo Grounds in September, Yankees play this key series that's going to determine the pennant between them and the Cleveland Indians. And there's this fabulous picture, which I have in the book, of Babe Ruth standing next to a guy with a pigeon, because the only way you could get information from the Polo Grounds in Upper Manhattan to the east side of Manhattan, where fans wanted to know what was going on, was by sending a carrier pigeon. Now, that's the same year that the first Major League game was broadcast out of Pittsburgh. But by 1927, the year Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs, the year he leads the Yankees to a four-game sweep over Pittsburgh, in which he hit the only two home runs in the series, by the way, the World Series is carried nationally, coast to coast, by two brand-new radio networks, NBC and CBS. So he's lucky. He comes along just at the moment where there's a way to capture the hugeness of him. And he was huge.
We're talking with Jane Levy, author of The Big Fella, Babe Ruth, and the World He Created. Let's go back to really where the legend all kind of starts, right? He's on the Red Sox. He's one of the great left-handed pitchers baseball has ever seen. All of a sudden, he wants to hit. A couple of years later, he's traded to the Yankees. And I was told, doing some research for this book, Jane, that you actually uncovered maybe the real reason why he was traded, and it maybe isn't what we all thought with the whole play with the Red Sox trying to their owner trying to finance it. What's the real story with Babe Ruth and the trade from Boston to New York?
Well, you know, Harry Frazee, the Red Sox owner, was broke, so it was not because of no Nanette, as has been frequently rumored. And he did need to borrow money from Jake Rupert. And Jake Rupert did understand, being a brewer in New York, that Prohibition was going to kick in January 1920, and that he was going to have to figure out a way to make money in a different way than selling beer. And what options did he have? He had option number one was to turn the Yankees, who had been a perennial failure, both financially and on the field, into a box office bonanza. And that's what Babe Ruth did for them almost immediately. Harry Frazee was snookered. He was snookered so badly by Jake Rupert, which is also one way of saying how desperate he was for cash, that he ended up paying in interest to Jake Rupert and the New York Yankees more than the purchase price of Babe Ruth. So the Red Sox actually financed the purchase of Babe Ruth for the Yankees.
Wow. That's unbelievable to even fathom. And, you know, when he gets to the Yankees, what was it like in New York at that time? Take us back from your research, everyone you spoke to, connected with him. How did Babe Ruth, essentially, as you talk about in your book, how did he create celebrity as we now basically know it?
Well, the first thing that happened is he started hitting more home runs. Now, you know, this guy was a revolutionary in a lot of ways. I don't think he would have said that to you. I don't think he set out to remake the entire game and the entire notion of fame. But, in fact, that's what he did. And in February 1921, an unemployed, recently fired and frequently fired, a PR and ad man named Christy Walsh, who was a guy out of Los Angeles, comes to Babe Ruth and suggests a syndicating deal, newspaper syndication deal, which he's going to sell columns under Babe Ruth's name. Now, ghostwriting was had been around for a while, since 1911, 1913, but Christy Walsh systematizes it. And he gives Babe Ruth more money. You know, Babe Ruth's been making $5 every time he sends back a telegram that says, hit another. Now Christy Walsh is actually creating copy under Babe Ruth's byline. And while it didn't say much, the fact is it was the only way a fan could hear what he thought was a hero's voice. Because, again, no radio yet. Well, Walsh was a visionary. And Walsh was actually the model for Jerry Maguire, if you want to think of it in those terms. So he slowly but surely, he grasps that that a new world is at hand and that athletes can be marketed, not just for what they do on the field, but as entertainers, as people who put tushies in seats and deserve to be paid for it, as people whose faces can be attached to shaving cream and cigars and everything under the sun that he can think of, he puts Babe Ruth's face on. And by the mid-20s, he had become not just the newspaper syndicator, but he had assumed complete control of all of Babe Ruth's finances. And he actually really saved him from financial ruin because Babe Ruth wasn't exactly moderate when it came to spending.
No question about that, as we're chatting with Jane Levy, author of The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. Her new book is out now. Jane, for you, when you look at Christy Walsh, one of the things that I thought was so fascinating just doing the research on the book is you really uncovered this guy that the Babe had around him. It always disappeared that Babe was kind of a guy that did his own thing, and he didn't really think too long and hard about some of the decisions he would make. He just wanted to be, you know, the life of every party. But it seems like a lot of things that the Babe did in his career was very calculated, and that seems to stem from Christy Walsh.
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, you can only guess how many stories Christy Walsh managed to suppress, given all the ones that did come out. It's, you know, I sit around and think, wow. What did he keep out of the press? Because, of course, he had a sweet system. He had guys who were covering Babe Ruth for New York City newspapers on his payroll as ghostwriters. Now, that kind of conflict of interest wouldn't exactly fly today, but nobody cared back then. And so, you know, he was guaranteed good press by the people who he was paying extra to write under Babe's name. And I mean, he redefined completely what it meant to be famous and the magnitude of fame. And of course, Babe Ruth dwarfed the game despite what Kennesaw Mountain Landis said in every conceivable way. He redesigned the architecture. He redesigned the equipment. He redesigned the baseball swing. I mean, here's a guy who comes along and basically takes the game out of the hands of managers like John McGraw, who are accustomed to moving guys around the bases as if they were chess pieces. You know, well, you'll just hit a little tepid little fly ball to left field and this guy will go from first to second, and that kind of station-to-station baseball. And Babe Ruth says, why should I do that? Why should I do that when I can, with one swing, hit a ball over the outfield fence? And it was such a radical proposition that the New Yorker magazine, actually in 1925, wrote this piece about how he had redefined the relationship between fans and the game. Because for that one instant, when the ball is going over the fence, the game and the fans have the ball in common, and it becomes like a unifying experience. And you can trace all of power baseball, all of the syncopation and the soundtrack of baseball. You know, all the booms and thwacks and thumps and things that accommodate every newscast still on baseball to Babe Ruth.
Jane Levy is our guest, of course, New York Times best-selling author. Her new book, The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. You know, one of the things you talk about in the book is the Babe's relationship with Lou Gehrig. I've heard the rumors just growing up reading a lot about Babe Ruth that maybe they didn't get along, that their personalities were totally different. What did you uncover about the Babe's relationship with Lou Gehrig?
Well, you know, their personalities were almost opposite, and their lives and their upbringings were opposite. I mean, Babe Ruth was a motherless boy. He was a young boy in Baltimore whose mother was divorced by his father after he accused her, and no one protested against the accusation, and not Kate Ruth nor her representatives, that she was an adulterer and that she drank too much. And so when George Herman Ruth Sr. divorces his wife, you know, Babe Ruth becomes motherless. Lou Gehrig, on the other hand, is famous for having been smothered by a mother and a father who were so attentive and so omnipresent that they were not entirely thrilled when he finally got married. Now, my book, it features the barnstorming tour that Babe and Lou take in 1927, you know, just weeks after he's hit the 60th home run, just 2 days after they finish off the Pirates in the World Series. And Lou Gehrig's still a young, very impressionable young guy who's inexperienced in every conceivable way. He's never been past the Mississippi River when they stop on a train in Ogden, Utah, and go for a ride through a canyon out there. You know, he's surprised that there are no cowboys and Indians. And he says later, well, you know, traveling around with a Babe was a real education. And I bet it was. But, you know, Christy Walsh, who was also along for the ride, used that as a way of promoting Babe Ruth, which is the last thing you would think of him, as this wise elder, you know, the guiding, an elder statesman who's going to guide Lou in the ways of the world. And at that point, they really were, if not close friends, they had a very good, jovial, kidding relationship, and I have a lot of scenes in the book on the barnstorming tour where you can see that it's affectionate. Where it fell apart was later. And, you know, one legend is that it has to do with Lou's mother being a busybody and criticizing the way Babe's second wife dressed his daughter from his first marriage. Which may or may not be true, but she was also kind of a tomboy, this kid Darcy, so it's hard to say whose fault that was exactly. But what is more true and substantiated by Eleanor Gehrig later was that in 1934, at the end of Babe's career, when they go off to Japan with an all-star team on a ship called the Empress, I think it's the Empress of Japan. Lou takes Eleanor, and it's going to be their honeymoon trip. And one day on ship, Eleanor Gehrig and Claire Ruth, Babe's second wife, run into each other on deck and say, "You know, this feud is really silly. Let's, you know, these guys need to get over it." And Claire invites Eleanor back to their stateroom to enjoy some champagne and caviar, of which apparently there was plenty. And she spends the afternoon basically having a good time with Claire and Babe Ruth, while Lou Gehrig, the earnest young man who, you know, married basically the first woman who paid attention to him other than his mother, is scanning the horizon with binoculars, worrying that his bride has gone overboard. And when he finds out where Eleanor has been all afternoon, he's none too pleased. He doesn't speak to her for a week, and he doesn't speak to Babe Ruth for years.
We're talking with Jane Levy, of course, author of The Big Fella, Babe Ruth, and the World He Created. A couple more for you, Jane, because I'm so fascinated by some of the legendary stories of the Babe. I do want to ask you about this. So, you know, anything you read about Babe Ruth or reenactments, films that have been made about him, it always shows the Babe with children and how great he was being around kids. In your research, did you ever get a good reason as to why the Babe was so receptive to children and just how important it was to kind of be that role model and be there for all the kids that grew up idolizing this guy in the 20s?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And the reason is this. When his parents' marriage disintegrated, and even prior to that, he was sent by his parents to an institution called St. Mary's Industrial School, which was on the western edge of Baltimore. And people always referred to it as an orphanage, which it was not. It was a school that accepted orphans, but they also took what they called wayward boys and incorrigible boys, the kids who were sent by the courts for being you know, in legal trouble. And there were two competing myths about the Babe. One was that he was an orphan, which was completely untrue, but he didn't ever really want to tell the real story of his family because, after all, who would, right? So while he would correct it, say, no, I wasn't an orphan, he would never go on to explain why he had been sent to St. Mary's. And so the other myth that grew up was that he was a bad kid who had been in trouble with the law. In fact, Babe Ruth was one of the few kids that were taken in by this institution who was a boarding student whose his father paid for him to be there. But he grew up in dorms where boys slept head to toe in wrought iron cots separated just wide enough for a bentwood chair to be there between the two beds and for them to get down on their knees and pray. They did everything together. They slept together. They ate together. They prayed together. They bathed together, and they played a whole lot of baseball together. And what Babe Ruth knew growing up in that environment was how to be public. What was hard for him later in life as an adult was to be alone. He never had any privacy growing up. He didn't know what to do with privacy. With all those pictures with him with boys, and there's one great one in the book that's on the end papers. It's that part, you know, right after you open the hardback, where he's subsumed by a crowd of 5,000 boys all trying to cluster into a single camera frame in Syracuse in August 1925. And they're draped over him. I mean literally draped like a fur boa that somebody might have worn in the 20s. And they can't get close enough to him. And he can't in any way thrive without that closeness. His granddaughter, one of his granddaughters, said to me about him that, you know, he made those kids and baseball his family. And that she used a fabulous phrase. She said he was a window wisher, one of those people who, when he would drive down the street or walk down the street and see an intact family sitting at a dinner table, you know, talking to each other, he'd look through the curtains and say, gee, I wish I had had that. And instead of that, he had those mobs of boys, kids who reminded him of what his family called Little George. And I think the affinity for them was genuine, and I think it filled a need in him as much as it did in them.
That's incredible. Jane Levy is our guest, of course, author of The Big Fella, Babe Ruth, and the World He Created. Jane, I'm so excited to read the book. I got my copy being sent out to me. I can't wait, and I appreciate you taking some time to join us this afternoon on SB Nation Radio.
It's an absolute pleasure. I'll sign it for you.
That sounds great. Thank you. Jane Levy, author of The Big Fella, Babe Ruth, and the World He Created. And our guest line is sponsored by BetDSI.com. Make sure you use promo code WIN125 and get 125% of your initial deposit today. Get all the plays and the inside line at BetDSI.com.